Hey, everybody, and welcome again to F This Movie, the official podcast of FThisMovie.com. Movie love for movie lovers. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I'm super excited for this week's show. It is our final show of 2023. Our annual rundown of the overrated, the underrated, and the ugly, which this year we're calling the underrated, the ugly, and we don't get it. Joined, as always, for the 12th or 13th time we've done this show, by the man in California, JB. Hi, JB.
And it's so early in the morning here. I'm still enjoying my protein shake. So this podcast is being brought to us by Premier Protein. Premier Protein, you never need to chew.
Don't be fooled, everyone. Protein shake is what he calls a fifth of vodka.
Busted.
Yeah. He's got a problem. And this is not a podcast. This is an intervention. J-Bones, Merry Christmas. Early New Year.
Merry Christmas. Man, this year's Christmas was, it seems like the lead up was really long.
Okay.
It seems like between Halloween and Christmas was 40 weeks.
Yes and no, because for me, those 40 weeks also flew by way too fast to the point where I couldn't enjoy things because so much is going on during that time.
You guys have been very busy. Apprised of the busyness.
Yeah.
Yesterday, when we were opening gifts, it was in this fog of haze because I both purchased and wrapped the gifts so long ago that all of them were a surprise to me as well.
Oh, fun. That's fun.
Oh, yeah, I bought that. Probably early November. So I'm actually welcoming dementia because that'll just get even better.
Christmas only improves. Next week is our best of 2023 episode and our coverage of our favorite movies of 2023 all week long on the website. This week, we're talking about some movies that maybe fell through the cracks, didn't make the cut. Maybe they will be on our list. Maybe they won't be on our list. I usually try and include movies that are not on my top 10 list for my underrated. J-Bones, you have a lot of underrated. I usually go 5-5-5, but it sounds like you have 10 underrated this year.
I tried to avoid stuff that we're going to talk about next week, but also so that it wasn't just an old guy griping about the cost of candy bars. One of the uses of this podcast might be that if these films fell through the cracks, and I would argue that they did fall through the cracks and didn't get talked about enough, people might use this podcast as a way of seeing some things that they missed during the year.
Definitely.
That they would like. In fact, the last thing I do when I prepare for this podcast is I go back to some website. Every year it's a different host, but I go back and I look at every film that was released in the year.
Yeah.
Because it's a handy memory check. And I found one that I had seen maybe 6 months ago that was delightful, but I had completely forgotten about it. So, okay. A, it fell through the cracks. B, I have dementia. Where did this protein shake come from?
Since we usually like to start on a positive note, we will start with our underrated picks. And J-Bone, since you have several more than me, I will let you go first.
These didn't get talked about enough. At least I don't think they did. And it's not like I'm locked in a closet. I'm plugged into the social media sites and other things where people talk. My number one underrated film was Air, the sneaker movie, which I went into with no hope whatsoever of it being anything. And yet, like many of the films on this list, it was so much better than it had any right to be. I know that they made a decision to sort of, after I saw it with my wife, I compared how they handled the Michael Jordan character to how the original Ben-Hur film handled showing the Christ. That is, you don't directly see the Christ.
You do not show the Godhead.
Yes, you see the bright light, or you see his garment, walking by the lepers or something. So when they only showed Michael Jordan walking past the leopards, and you just saw this, the iconic sneaker, I thought that was an odd choice. I didn't read a lot about the film before it came out, and I went to it really cold. I did not know what to expect, and I thought it was really good.
Yeah, it's a good movie featuring likable performances in which people like talk to each other. And those movies are fewer and further between. It's also one of the better, I would maybe argue the best example from this year, although there's one that is in contention, for a trend that I don't really like in movies that's going on right now, which is like the product movie. We had Flamin' Hot, and we had the Beanie Bubble, and we had Blackberry, which is the other one that I would say kind of gives Air a run for its money in terms of being the best of these movies from this year.
And wasn't there something very much like Air last year, the year before?
Yeah, it's
not so much about a product, but a narrowly focused film about some social phenomenon that was very talky.
I'm sure there was, but I don't remember. I mean, they're all sort of chasing The Social Network. That was kind of the original version of this movie. And then
just described it, it's almost like a highbrow version of when they tried to turn all those Hasbro movies.
Yeah, right.
It's just a little bit more ambitious.
And I worry that because this was an Amazon movie, it got a theatrical release, but then it went to Amazon Prime. It's one of these movies that is ephemeral. It kind of doesn't exist, and it should. It's, you know, directed by Ben Affleck. It stars him and Matt Damon. It's a really well done film for what it is.
For what this is.
Yeah.
It's done well. And at this point, I will become the drunk uncle complaining about the cost of candy bars, because the other night we had nothing better to do, and we promised each other if it was as bad as we expected, we would bail. Frequently, if it's on streaming and we're not familiar with it, that's the promise. That's the implicit promise we make to ourselves. Oddly enough, we never bail.
No, I don't bail on a movie. Yeah,
I can't remember the last time I shut something off. But here's my point. We watched the Eddie Murphy Christmas movie, Candy Cane Lane, which was not awful.
Sure.
It had a few things to recommend it. But let me shut this off. Because this has been a great Christmas, probably the most depressing moment of this Christmas was, for some strange reason, maybe because we were expecting funny outtakes, we watched the entire end credit crawl. We were expecting a little Easter eggs or something. And at the very end, the last credit was the copyright notice. And it was copyright Roman numeral, Amazon Content Services.
Oof.
Oh.
There it is.
So it's not a studio.
No.
And it's not a movie.
A provider of content.
Oh, God in heaven.
That's where we're at. And it's not all bad, because as we'll see next week, there are some streaming movies that made my top 10 list. So it's not like streamers are where movies go to die. But it is harder to prove that these movies exist, because they're just lost in an algorithm.
And several times this year, it was like, oh, it's streaming already. Oh, joy. I don't have to get on my scooter and cross the 101. I could watch it from the comfort of my home. But secretly, I wish that wasn't true, because I love going to the movies.
Right, right.
And I don't want
an
excuse to, in one case, there's a high-profile indie release that I still haven't watched because the pay-per-view is $20.
No, I don't blame you. I can't pull the trigger on $20 rentals.
To all of you Amazon content service providers listening to the podcast, my threshold is $5 or $6. Charge $5 or $6 and I'm there.
Yeah.
But 20 gives me pause. My next underrated film was a recommendation from you, Mr.
Woo-hoo.
Brown. And we talked about this when it came out, and it left both of us shaking our heads because it didn't get a theatrical release, and God damn, it should have, because I so wish I had seen it in a theater where it's dark and quiet and you can focus more than you can in your great room. No one will save you.
That was actually, I will give Rob credit for that. That was a recommendation from Rob.
The bone of contention was there wasn't enough dialogue to keep monkeys in the theater focused on the action. There weren't enough shiny objects and people yelling or something. But talk about a film with an imagination. Talk about a film that takes you on an interesting journey where you can't predict what the second act was going to be. Talk about a performance by the lead actress.
Yeah.
When you look at some of the shit that got a theatrical release.
And that was one of those, correct me if I'm wrong, that was like a 20th Century Studios, formerly Fox, that got kind of fucked over in the Disney merger. So it just goes straight to Hulu. Yeah. Okay.
And I may be wrong, but I'm remembering that the last line of Rob's review is "No One Will Save You" is available on streaming because no one in Hollywood knows what they're doing anymore.
That sounds right. Yeah.
Even the fact that it's a horror film in theory,
yeah,
would guarantee that it would do some business in October. So even that leaves me scratching my head, because I think if you showed No One Will Save You in a crowded movie theater with young people, you'd get a similar reaction that you got with Talk to Me.
Really?
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
Now, I'm assuming a lot on the part of the audience, and
yeah.
Maybe what you said is true, that the lack of dialogue would lead young people to supply their own or something. But no one's talking in this film. Let's talk ourselves. let's yell what we think they should be saying. But if you haven't seen No One Will Save You and you're listening to this podcast, you need to, because I can almost guarantee that you'll have a good time.
It's streaming on Hulu. I'm going to say something potentially controversial, not in regards to No One Will Save You, although it applies, but I liked No One Will Save You and I like Brian Duffield and I'm super excited to see what he does next. But I personally am a little over the horror movie as metaphor for personal trauma.
Oh, yeah.
We've seen a lot of that since The Babadook, I would say, is kind of the jumping off point for that phenomenon. And it's like every indie horror movie now. So I'm a little burned out on that.
That's
again,
the trope.
Movies do it well, movies do it poorly. This one does it well.
Every decade we get the trope. I'm thinking back to AIDS vampires.
Sure.
That was briefly popular.
And a shitty title for a movie.
I told Albert Queen not to make that one.
How dare you, sir, speak ill of the Pune. I will do my first one because it's kind of a trifecta, and that is the Nicolas Cage movie that's underrated, because Nicolas Cage made six movies this year. I would argue three of them are underrated. Two of them are Westerns, and I always have Westerns on this list for some reason. When you do our underrated list, I'll bet if you went back the last 13 years, I have at least one Western on every list.
Because we keep being told the genre is dead, and yet every year...
Yeah, a kind of good one comes out. He made two Westerns. One is called Butcher's Crossing, and one is called The Old Way. Butcher's Crossing is about buffalo hunting. The Old Way is a more traditional kind of revenge Western. Neither one is quite great because I think they're both limited by their budget, by their digital cinematography. They don't always feel like a Western should feel. But I think they're both good. I think they have interesting lead performances by Nicolas Cage. The Old Way is currently streaming on Hulu. Butcher's Crossing is still one of those $20 rentals. I would say wait until it's a $5 rental and watch it then, because I think it's definitely worth seeing for $5, because it's about something that I haven't seen a movie about before, which is this idea of these men who go into this dangerous territory specifically to hunt buffalo and sort of what happens as a result. And it's about more than what it's about. My pick for the most underrated Nicolas Cage movie of the year, and the reason I chose it as being the most underrated, is because I've heard people call this the worst movie of the year, and that's Renfield. I will concede, I just rewatched it last week in preparation for this show. I will concede that there's a lot of stuff with Awkwafina as a cop and John Ralphio as a gangster and sort of this war between the cops and the gangsters. It exists to increase the body count. On the one hand, like on a story level, I'm against it, but on an increase the body count level, I'm for it, because it's a lot of fun watching these guys get torn apart and fucked up. The movie's very bloody and I enjoy that. All the stuff about the sort of parasocial relationship between Renfield and Dracula, I think, is so funny. The recreation of the original 1931 Dracula with Nicholas Holt and Nicolas Cage at the beginning of the movie, I think, is so clever. Cage is having a blast as Dracula, not doing a Bela Lugosi impression. It is imperfect, to be sure, but to me, it is like the definition of a movie that is underappreciated because so much hate was thrown against it, and I think it's a lot better than its reputation.
In the words of you, I was very excited for Renfield, and
sure,
I went, and it's a movie where you can see the different color script pages because it's two movies, yeah, like the movie Bridesmaids. It's two movies awkwardly shoved together.
Yeah.
And one of them is the script that got Nicolas Cage to sign on. And it's everything you're saying with Nicolas Holt and being codependent. And then there's this other movie going on at the same time, which, like you said, we need bodies and special effects, but the two halves don't fit together.
Right.
And the Nicolas Holt, Nicolas Cage stuff is so good, and Nicolas Cage is so obviously having a ball, that you wish that were the entire film.
Definitely.
So Renfield made my I don't get it list.
Okay.
Because I was unaware of the hatred.
Yeah.
I just wanted it to be so much better than it was.
Understood.
Mostly because of the people involved. And do you remember all the teasing on Twitter where they released two pictures of him in the makeup on the first day of shooting?
Again, the internet like exists to build you up and tear you down, because everyone was like, Nicolas Cage playing Dracula, I can't wait. This movie needs to come out now. Look, here's a single image of him dressed as Dracula. This movie needs to come out today. I can't wait. And the day it comes out, it's like, fuck this movie. This movie sucks. Okay.
It was quickly dismissed.
Yeah.
So my third underrated film, and I'm wondering if you've seen it, there's a wonderful movie theater in Santa Monica called The Arrow. And because
Arrow.
Directors and actors largely live in Hollywood, Arrow has cornered the market on, you go to a screening at The Arrow, there's going to be a Q&A afterwards with someone pretty exciting.
Yeah.
And so I think they've had it already, but they screened this film, and the director and one of the lead actors was in attendance. And I wanted to go to that screening just for the Q&A, because I knew nothing about this film at all. Jan had read something about it, and so we watched it either streaming or pay-per-view. And it was so much better than it had any right to be. But the fact that it stars Ben Kingsley should have been an indication that it was going to at least be interesting, because Ben Kingsley, for the most part, doesn't do garbage. It's called Jewels.
Nope, not on my radar.
It's about an old man who's largely ignored. His daughter thinks that he's in the first stages of Parkinson's. We see him walking everywhere. We suspect it's because he's lost his license. Every week he shows up at the town council meeting and makes the same three objections. He doesn't like the town motto. He thinks it should be changed for grammatical reasons. There's a There's a crosswalk he wants. And so we see the ordinariness of his life. And there's two women who live in the town, one of whom is Jane Curtin, who delivers an amazing performance too. I don't think I'm spoiling anything. One night, a spaceship lands in his backyard, and it contains an alien who's injured. And the Ben Kingsley character tries to tell this to many people, and no one believes him, to the extent that no one even goes to his house to check it out. And the film goes on from there. And the alien is not a special effect. It's an actor in makeup, which was a wise choice because the other actors can actually interact with the character. And it reminded me of a very obscure film from the 60s called The Heart is a Lonely Hunter, based on a novel by Carson McCullers, where the main character is mute. And so one of the tropes of the film is that everyone talks to this guy because he's a Rorschach inkblot. They like to talk to him because what they're getting back is what they want to get back, sure, because he's not providing anything. So that's another thing I liked about it. It's a small, low-budget film that has a lot of interesting ideas on its mind. Much better than 80 for Brady. It really has a feeling for what it's like to get old in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just delightful. I'm not saying it's the greatest, most ambitious film ever made, but it was a hell of an evening. And I'm so glad we watched it. And that's why I wanted to go to the Arrow screening, because the two guests were the other old woman, who's not Jane Curtin, whose name I can't remember, and I'll just say the little stunt person who played the alien.
Okay.
Was part of the Q&A. So I wanted to go see it for that reason. And I can't believe I'm talking about a film you haven't seen.
I don't think it's out yet. I haven't been able to find any information on it, like, available to see. So
it's, but I watched it at home.
Oh, then I don't understand.
So
I probably just spelled it wrong.
I
was searching for it.
I never pay attention to what streaming service we're using.
I see it now. Okay.
I'm guessing Amazon.
It's on Paramount Plus.
And it was, oh, but that's the one I don't subscribe to. So I'm guessing I rented it pay-per-view on
Amazon. Yeah, you can rent it. It's on Paramount Plus. It's on Showtime. I typed it in Jewels, as in like where Chicago people buy their groceries, like at the Jewels.
It's well worth our listeners' time. It was an unexpected delight.
Okay, very nice. My next pick is a streamer. Speaking of streamers, it is, I think, the best movie produced through the Adam Sandler Netflix collaboration, and that is You Are So Not Invited to My Bat Mitzvah, a movie that reeks of a vanity project in which he casts his wife and kids in a sort of young adult coming of age movie, but it's so much better than that.
So much better than Grown Ups,
where it's just a paid vacation for his friends. It is. It's a really good movie about, you know, I think his daughters are very talented. Sunny Sandler, I think, I hope I'm not confusing them, sort of plays the lead, and she's a girl who's about to make her bat mitzvah. She wants to have this big party. She has a falling out with her friend. I think it's very honest about a lot of sort of touchstones about this age in a way that a lot of movies aren't. I know Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret is getting a lot of love this year. Deservedly so. I think it's really good. But I also think You Are So Not Invited to My Bat Mitzvah should be part of that same conversation, because I think it has a lot of sort of Judy Blumness in its honesty and its depiction of what it's like to be a young woman growing up. It's also a movie that, you know, is a lot about what it means to be Jewish and that faith at a time when obviously there's a lot of sort of upheaval in the world surrounding, there's a lot of anti-Semitism going on. You know, it's a scary, scary time. And I think this movie is kind of beautiful in terms of what it has to say about the Jewish faith. And Sarah Sherman from Saturday Night Live plays a rabbi who's really, really good in the movie. I just thought it was so I went into it because my daughter, we were looking for something to watch as a family. I went into it with very low expectations because I'm a cynical prick. And I was like, here's Adam Sandler putting his daughters in a movie. And I was so won over by it. There were 3 weeks straight where Rosie watched it every night as she fell asleep.
So you're saying it's better than Hubie Halloween?
I do love Hubie Halloween. I think it's probably a better movie than Hubie Halloween. Like, I like Hubie Halloween for the Halloween vibes, and I think it's funny, but I think this is a better movie.
And my wife saw it with you.
She did. She was here
she
when
was
we watched
visiting,
it. Yeah.
And she came back and she was raving about it.
Yeah.
And that made me want to see it.
It's good.
My next underrated film came out, got some attention, and then completely disappeared from view. It took a week, and suddenly the film discourse in this country was one film short. It's called Dumb Money, and it's the film about the GameStop.
Another
stock.
Sort of product social network movie. Not exactly, but...
I would lump it in with... oh, my God. The Margot Robbie sits in
yeah,
a bathtub
the
and
Big
explains
Short.
Things. That it's very much like The Big Short, only with a smaller focus. I'm not the biggest Paul Dano fan, but I thought he was really good in this.
Mm-hmm.
I actually thought Pete Davidson was trying to expand the stock character that he seems doomed to play for the rest of his life. I thought it did a very good job explaining the entire complicated mess. And like Ford versus Ferrari, which I wound up loving that year more than I had any right to. I love the fact that it was an American film that once again suggested if you start poor in this country, you're fucked.
Mm-hmm.
Because the whole subplot of these hedge funds manipulating the system so that they don't lose.
Right.
And of course, these are all always the same people who tell us that we should raise ourselves up from our bootstraps, that whole rhetoric. I loved, especially the sort of cameo stars they got to play, the three hedge fund managers. And I love the fact that the three hedge funds are not equal and that the smallest of the hedge funds winds up getting fucked too, because I'm sorry, while you're a hedge fund, you're not big enough to not get fucked.
Yeah.
It was really entertaining, and it's one of those movies that after you see it, it disappears.
Yeah. Yeah. Such is the fate of movies now. If you don't
but
become
if you've
a big
avoided Dumb Money, seek it out because it's definitely worth your two hours.
I want to see it. Speaking of, I think when I was talking about my Nicolas Cage trifecta, I said The Old Way is a revenge Western. I said Renfield is fun to watch specifically for the violence and body count. I have a movie that outdoes both of those movies in terms of a revenge movie with a high body count and glorious violence. And that is a Finnish movie called Sisu, in which a prospector is robbed by Nazis of his gold and spends the rest of the movie fucking up Nazis. And going back to what I was saying, you know, I don't want to get political on the show, but I had said we're in challenging times. There's a lot of rampant anti-Semitism going on in the world, and certain viewpoints have been emboldened by current events. And there's never been a better time to watch Nazis get fucked up. Sisu finds wonderful things to do to the human body, much of it done practically. It is a very it's John Wick in World War II with a Finnish prospector who doesn't really talk. Speaking of no one here will save you or whatever, no one will save you. Man, I had a good time watching it.
And I remember I started to read things about it on Twitter because people were raving about it.
Yeah.
And it played at a theater by my house, and I went to see it, and it's so much fun. And it's really a marvel of how you can do this well, that you can take not a one joke idea, but a one, he's going to kill these Nazis,
Right.
and expand it to feature length so that it doesn't resemble a video game. And the way you do that is there are different sequences in which the problem is slightly different and he kills them in slightly different ways. I did hear criticism that he's presented as unkillable, that the trope of the film is that they keep getting close to doing him in, but he just keeps coming back. But I like that because, like in a Sergio Leone film, he almost becomes a ghost. This is the wrath of the Jewish people who has come to bring revenge to bear. And the performance by the lead actor as the title character is amazing, especially in light of how little dialogue there was. And it was just fun. And again, in real life, I'm against violence. I think punching someone usually just gets you punched back. But my exception to this is Nazis. There's that one video clip that went viral of that famous fucking Nazi. And I say fucking Nazi because my father fought the Nazis in World War II. And I had this crazy notion that we were done with that because the world recognized. Okay, I won't get off on a diatribe. It became a meme on the Twitter machine, I believe, where some famous Nazi asshole who was on Fox News a lot or something got punched on the street. And like someone edited it into a video where he just gets punched and punched and punched, and then like in slow motion, and people started playing with it. I don't have a problem with punching Nazis. I really don't.
I thought you were going to go a different way, which is like, I don't really like real life violence, and I'm the same way, but I do really enjoy movie violence, and
And
Sisu is a symphony of movie violence.
there is a difference. And right now at the Ronald Reagan Library, which is just up the road from me, the featured exhibit that's traveling that is there for a while and then leaves is about Auschwitz.
Oh, wow.
And we haven't gone because, in all honesty,
Yeah.
it's not my idea of a fun afternoon, and I honestly didn't think I could take it. But oh, JB, they're human beings. You shouldn't punch Nazis. Okay, well, you go to the Auschwitz exhibit and give it your time and then come back and make that argument. I agree. Sisu might have been the feel-good movie of 2023. Put that on the video box.
Please do.
The feel-good movie of 2023. JB. Nazi punching F this movies.
What is your next underrated pick?
Well, I'll tell you, you know I'm not the biggest fan of Tom Cruise, although I'm slowly coming around. And I went to see this Mission Impossible film, Dead Reckoning, and it was just fucking awesome.
Yeah.
It was one of the best action movies I've seen in a long time. It was like the filmmakers channeled the spirit of Buster Keaton and watched The General and then said, "Hold my beer." And that's just one of the sequences. It is awesome. Talking about getting your money's worth,
Yeah.
I think there's six action sequences, and one of them is big. Oh my God. And I guess fewer people went than they expected, and
Yeah.
they're not going to call the next one Dead Reckoning Part Two because apparently Dead Reckoning didn't make the consumer impression from Amazon content service. Anyway, talk about getting your money's worth. And my next one is John Wick 4, which I would say the same thing about.
Yeah.
These amazing action films that give action movie fans exactly what they want, done at the top of everyone's game. And there's no talk, and fewer people go than they're expecting, and then they disappear.
Yeah. No, we are living
now,
in
later,
a
John Wick 4 will show up because they'll rebox all of them into the John Wick collection. So they'll shoehorn 4 into it. But 4 was really interesting. And I think we talked about this at some point in the year, that it seemed to be made for John Wick fans. Because casual action movie fans do not have the patience for the staircase scene at the end of the film. And yet, it was unbelievably entertaining.
Yes.
Because of what would make some people criticize it.
Right, right.
Man, hey, dude, that was 20 minutes long. Yeah. Yeah.
I wish it was 30.
Could it be the Steven Spielberg syndrome, where Spielberg is so great and accomplished that his films get dismissed, almost like, oh, well, that's Steven Spielberg.
Right.
Like, now when you go back and rewatch Bridge of Spies, which I did recently, it is so incredible. It's like, why weren't people talking about this? Even something like The Post, which I recently rewatched, it's so effortlessly good that people take it for granted.
Yeah, he gets graded on a curve.
What does Tom Cruise have to do now? He's what, 82 years old? He's still doing these stunts. He's giving, come on.
Yeah, I'm with you. Those are two of the best. Those are the two best studio released action movies of the year. I didn't see every action movie, so I can't say they were the two best action movies of the year. But in terms of like wide release, those are the two best.
See them.
My next two, since I'm trying to keep it to five, but really I'm talking about eight or nine. I'll pair together just because they're both. Well, they don't make any sense to pair together. I'll just say No Hard Feelings. I was going to say Megan because I think Megan is better than its reputation as a meme suggests. But I'll just say No Hard Feelings, which I'm recommending. And I think it's streaming on Netflix now. Because we don't get many Hollywood comedies anymore. And B, because I think Jennifer Lawrence is so fucking good in this movie doing for comedy and just like whatever this movie, if we call it a romantic comedy, it's not really, it's just a comedy. What Tom Cruise does in Mission Impossible, which is just like bringing fucking maximum movie star wattage. And we have fewer and fewer movie stars now that we don't appreciate the ones that we have. And when Jennifer Lawrence, what she does in No Hard Feelings is hard to be that good without seeming like you're trying, without, you know, when Tom Cruise does it, we're like, well, he threw himself off a building. He's hanging from a train. He's killing himself for our approval. And Jennifer Lawrence is like, well, she got naked on a beach and wrestled some guys. But like, well, what she's doing is really difficult. Yeah.
She was effortlessly charming, which seems easy until you try.
Right.
That film was on an earlier version of this list, but I wound up getting so flummoxed because I kept confusing it with You Hurt My Feelings that I decided the easiest thing would be to just drop the Jennifer Lawrence. But I'm glad you brought it up because that was sort of my guilty pleasure for the year. I went to see it, and going in, I was like, this screams her representation saying, you need to branch out.
Oh, I don't doubt it.
You make a certain kind of film, we need to move you into a different market. Here, yep. I've got this report from Amazon Content Services. And it was so much better than it had any right to be. And it actually understood things about romantic comedies in terms of what needs to happen in terms of the structure and stuff. But I thought all the performances were good. I thought Jennifer Lawrence was amazing. Talk about a star vehicle. And I hope people didn't avoid it because when it came out, the marketing itself seemed really cynical.
Well, it goes back to that thing that I think a lot of movies have been trying to do, not since Bridesmaids, but like Girls Trip kind of did it, Joyride kind of did it this year, No Hard Feelings kind of did it, where it's like, see, girls can be dirty too. We can make sex movies about girls. And it is very
and that's a
cynical.
big and that's a big part of the marketing.
Yeah.
And hoopa, 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 and it's dirty.
Right, exactly. Here's the Red Band trailer. Are you ready for this? But it's better than that, and it's very sweet, and it's very good, and it's about something, which is like gig economy. And again, the fucking horrors of capitalism, you know, like.
And I thought the actors who played the couple who are her best friends.
Yes.
Were really, really good, too.
Yeah,
and
it's good.
Played those parts well. Matthew Broderick seemed very uncomfortable. I don't know why.
The woman who plays his wife, Laura Benanti, used to play Melania Trump on the Colbert Show. So it's hard to watch her in the movie. And she's really funny, but like I watch her and I'm just like, oh, that's Melania.
So the film I kept confusing No Hard Feelings with is You Hurt My Feelings. And it gives me hope that Nicole Holofcener's films continue to get a theatrical release.
Yeah.
Because if anything, I think those scream streaming
right
much more than No One Will Save You.
Right.
Maybe it's the star power she attracts. And I didn't like it as much as previous Nicole Holofcener films, but it's a solid piece of work.
Definitely.
That's, like you said, actually about something and is really funny and heartfelt.
Yeah. Gives a good vehicle for Julia Louis-Dreyfus, who is, I never watched Veep, but, you know, kind of underserved in movies. I know she's obviously done very well on TV and she's not hurting for money, but like, I like when she shows up and stuff. And so for her to get a great role like she does in You Hurt My Feelings is nice. And Nicole Holofcener movies are, they feel like movies only she could have made. Nobody else is making movies like Nicole Holofcener. And she's one of my favorites. I'm so glad there's still room for her.
They're all great. They all take place in a similar universe.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to remember, was it called Enough Said?
The Gandolfini one?
Right.
Yeah.
Which, if our listeners haven't seen that, that's from a couple of years ago, obviously. That one's incredibly strong, too. And
yeah,
it's just this, maybe they don't stand a chance in the market because there's nothing else on the market like it ever.
Right.
And occasionally she gives Oliver Platt a chance to play a part that's unlike the stock parts he's made his bread and butter.
Right. Yeah. He's so good in Please Give, which is
yeah,
maybe my favorite of her movies. I think it's just so good. My last underrated pick probably is not an underrated movie in that it cost a bunch of money. It made, I think, a lot of money. And based on something I tweeted out a couple weeks ago, there's a large groundswell of support for this movie. But it's Dungeons and Dragons Honor Among Thieves, which I went into with pretty low expectations because it's just, hey, we have an IP. We have to exploit it. I'm not always the biggest fantasy guy. It's just a movie that works in every way that it should. I think it rewards Dungeons and Dragons fans, but I think it works for casual moviegoers. It's very funny. Chris Pine is incredibly charming. Michelle Rodriguez gets a chance to be great in a movie, and she's been stranded in fucking Fast X territory for so long that you forget what she can bring to a movie.
Everything she's been in has been a trap.
Yeah, and you forget that, like, oh, if you give her a good role, she does something that other people can't do in movies, and she's so well served by it. There's a weird Bradley Cooper cameo that I know I just spoiled. Ooh. Hugh Grant is coasting a little bit, but like, it's fun to see Hugh Grant show up and stuff. The effects are really fun. Some of the CG is a little wonky, but there's a lot of practical stuff that's really, really cool. It's just like a really, really good movie that you wish, it feels like a blockbuster from 20 years ago where care was put into every aspect of the movie. And it's written and directed by the guys who did Game Night. It's John Francis Daley.
Well, that's a high recommendation. Game Night defines underrated. That came out and everyone thought it was this, and it turns out it was So much better. Last night we watched Licorice Pizza
Nice.
for as one does at Christmas,
Yeah.
and I was watching it, and I remembered that Bradley Cooper filmed his segment during the break of Nightmare Alley. Nightmare Alley was filmed in two
Right.
chunks, and they took time off in the middle, and that's when he did Licorice Pizza.
Right.
And then we're watching it, and my son is a big PTA fan, and so there's the scene where the truck pulls up and they're unloading the waterbed, and Jake turns to us and says, "First day of filming." In fact, I think he pointed out the first shot they did. Because, as you know, listeners, films are not made in the order they're presented
Right.
on camera.
We'll
And
come
I
back
was
to
just,
Bradley Cooper, but he's
oh,
amazing. He's
we'll come back
amazing
to
at
Bradley
Licorice
Cooper.
Pizza.
Could it be Brad Pitt syndrome, where someone who thinks they're a lead is a character actor at heart? I also thought that last night watching Sean Penn in Licorice Pizza. My God, I like him better in supporting roles, unless he's playing Harvey Milk. Oddly enough, I avoided Dungeons and Dragons
Yeah.
because A, I didn't know it was the game night guys, and B, because of something you said.
Uh-oh, what did I do?
When the trailer came out,
Oh, yeah.
you said this is a perfect example of the new smart ass,
Yes.
tongue in cheek action film
Yes.
where you get an expensive CGI effect, and then a character in the film says, "Well, that happened."
Exactly. The movie is not that. I think it was
And
marketed that way.
that's why I didn't go.
It is marketed that way. The movie is not that at all. It is very, it has a sense of humor, but I would
Would
argue
you
it's very
compare it to Princess
sincere.
Bride?
I mean, that's a little, that's reaching, I think.
Okay.
But it's more Princess Bride than it is Marvel, for
Well,
sure.
as I usually do at this juncture, in this podcast every year, I've taken out post-it notes, and I'm jotting down little notes to myself of things that I still need to see.
It's worthless to test this because you don't have Paramount Plus, but it is streaming on Paramount Plus.
Do I need Paramount Plus?
I don't think so because I don't know what else is on there besides Jewels and Dungeons and Dragons: Honor Among Thieves.
I wanted to
But
see the Godfather thing.
what's oh that show? I didn't watch it.
Yeah,
Yeah.
that thing. Every year at this time, I vow to drop some streaming services because I have too many. And I never do. I always wind up keeping them all. So I don't know. Paramount Plus is a thing. You're out. So
I'm
just
out.
very briefly, here are the rest of my underrated films, films that I don't think got talked about enough. Dream Scenario, speaking of our friend Nicolas Cage, is amazing. And other than the fact that it's one of six Nicolas Cage films, and it did get some critical attention, I don't think it's getting the attention it deserves
Not at
because
all.
Mr. Bromley, am I safe in saying it's the best Nicolas Cage film of this year?
Very safe in saying that, yes. It's in
Hands
a
down.
class unto itself when it comes to Nicolas Cage movies of 2023.
Because not only does it have a Nicolas Cage performance, which alone is worth seeing something, but everything else in the movie is up to Nicolas Cage's participation,
Yeah.
including the central conceit, which I will not spoil.
I don't know if it was his participation, and people have generally written him off, unless it's in an ironic sense, like again, there was a lot of anticipation for Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent, and then it came out and everybody ignored it. But there was this ironic, like, look, he's playing himself. We love that. Or if it looked too much like a Spike Jonze, Charlie Kaufman movie, which I would argue is a good thing. But I
And I
don't know
would say,
what the reason was that people ignored Dream Scenario. I don't understand it.
in Dream Scenario, he's playing against type.
Yes.
He's not giving what people might brand the Nicolas Cage performance, whatever that might be.
Right. I will have more to say about that movie a week from now.
I finally caught up with Thanksgiving, which was more fun than it had any right to be.
It's
My
great.
son got invited to an early screening, I think before it was released, and he was raving about it. And oh God, Eli Roth loves movies and loves people who loves movies. And it was just so much fun. I also thought it was very telling the two changes they made from the trailer that was in Grindhouse. Because for anyone who would watch Thanksgiving and say, oh my God, this is really over the top. Well, no, they actually toned two things down. I'm still confused because there's two characters we lose, and they're not part of that dinner party at the end. So I'm guessing, A, they're collateral damage, but they're major minor characters, so I expected them to make the dinner party. But also, I thought it screamed that something got cut.
Perhaps.
There's a football player. He's the football player who's white. For
Yeah.
the first half of the movie, I thought it was Nick Jonas. It is not Nick Jonas. We looked it up. He and his girlfriend are lured into the school and dispatched. And you keep waiting for that to pay off
Right.
because everyone is that just me thinking too much about the film?
The girlfriend is the one on the trampoline, yes?
Yes.
Okay.
Wait.
I
No.
thought. No?
No.
Okay. Then I'm thinking of the wrong thing.
Because the girl on the trampoline is the guy who's like a teaching assistant who's driving everyone in the weight room, who's watching her on the trampoline, but doesn't get to see the culmination of the trampoline scene because,
Oh, right.
not that it's sloppy, it's just the rest of the film is so meticulous in how it reaches this horrific conclusion. At one point, Jan commented that of all the bad deaths, being cooked in an oven.
That's rough.
Like Stephen King says, there's good deaths and there's bad deaths.
Yeah.
So Thanksgiving was a lot of fun if you haven't caught up with it. Halfway through the year, a film was released. I don't know if it got a theatrical release. We saw it on streaming. It's called Pinball, The Man Who Saved the Game. And obviously, I love pinball and I own a pinball machine, so I'm the audience for this film. But again, like Dumb Money, it was so much better than it had any right to be. And one of the things I liked about it best was it starred
Is this
either
Taryn?
Mark or Mike Feist,
Mike Feist, yeah.
who's in West Side Story.
Yeah.
But in Pinball, he's playing, well, first of all, spoiler alert, he doesn't sing and dance. And he's playing a very, very different character. And the film recreates the 70s, where in New York, in the film, but also in other places like, oh, I don't know, Schaumburg, Illinois, pinball was illegal for decades. The argument being because it's a coin-operated amusement device, organized crime was using it to launder money. And the movie is about the journalist who, A, loves pinball, and B, actually fought that in court to get that law overturned. And it's not the most ambitious film ever made, but it defines niche, but it's certainly worth your time. And in a lot of ways, was a lot like Flamin' Hot. As you said, with Social Network as the model of something big budget, we get all these movies like Air and Pinball and Flaming Hot and The Beanie Bubble, which I actually thought was entertaining,
It's
but
fine,
sad.
yeah.
That clearly, given a choice between how a Frito-Lay company janitor becomes the president of the company because he has this idea of an audience that's being underserved by this food conglomerate, I'd much rather see that than Battleship the movie.
Yes.
But that's just me. Maybe it's because I like Cheetos and I don't own a battleship. But again, if this list is going to be useful, if you're listening to this podcast and you haven't seen Pinball, The Man Who Saved the Game, or Flamin' Hot, there's much worse uses of your time. They're both very entertaining. And until it was over, I didn't realize that Flamin' Hot was directed by Eva Longoria, because another screening at the Arrow was, Arrow. Oh my God, a theatrical screening of Flaming Hot with half the cast and Eva Longoria.
Oh, wow.
Also, I suspect they had the participation of the Frito-Lay people, because the factory.
Yeah.
Jan is the expert on this because she's done factory tours for her
right,
job.
Right.
When we went, when we watched Candy Cane Lane, Eddie Murphy's wife works in this facility that looks very much like an Amazon fulfillment house. And we were arguing about if it was a movie set or if they actually went to an Amazon fulfillment house, because the movie was made by Amazon Content Services. It seems to me Flamin' Hot had the full cooperation, because whenever they show the factory, you're looking at it and you're like, now this is an art direction. Yeah. They're making Cheetos here.
I haven't seen Flaming Hot, but it is, it's like a little bit of a commercial for Frito-Lay, right? In the way that Air is a commercial for Nike.
Yes. When it's over, you want some Flaming Hot Cheetos.
Yeah, that will never happen for me.
I remember your lovely wife was the first person to ever introduce me to the concept that many high school students will grab a bag of Flaming Hot Cheetos and then surreptitiously open
a cup
it.
Of a cup of nacho cheese.
Well, no, that they would go under the spigot for the nacho cheese in the cafeteria and pour it right into the bag.
Yeah.
Grab a fork, and that's lunch. That until your wife introduced me to that cuisine, I was unaware of it, because that was not going on at the high school I worked in northern Minnesota. Maybe it's a Minnesota thing.
Is that it for your underrated picks?
That's it for my underrated picks. You will have a wonderful evening.
That's like almost 20 movies, everyone.
Watching any of the films that we just talked about.
Yeah. And that's not even, in our, none of those are, well, most of those are not on our top 10s. So lots of recommendations here, which I'm saying to assuage my guilt about where we're going.
At this point, can I address the 800-pound gorilla in the room?
Absolutely.
I deliberately wanted to have this conversation with Patrick because I didn't want to gum up the works next week by bringing this up. Three films were released this year that had a lot of, everyone was looking forward to them. And there are three major films that will attract all of the award representation. And these are the greatest films ever made by major filmmakers. And the three films have a lot in common.
Okay.
And why
are we in the I don't get it now?
Yes.
Okay. Because I have three films on my I don't get it, but I'll bet two of them are not the same.
Is it okay that we're on I don't get it?
Yeah, of course.
Okay.
This, we used to call this, everybody, if you're listening for the first time, we used to call this overrated, but overrated. I have a problem with that, just because you're saying, when you say overrated, you're saying what you're wrong to like what you like. And if you like any of these movies, that's fine. That's great. You're the winner.
If you like these movies, I need to talk to you, because I'm starting to think that the people who like them are fake mythic people who don't exist, because I'm responding to the marketing machinery that has released these films as masterpieces before they open.
I think that happens, but I am responding to people, actual people, not bots, that I have seen online or listened to on podcasts talk about these movies and place them very high, sometimes on their top 10 lists.
And I'm sure
these
I'm sure these three films, and again, they're not equal, because I can see where one of them is probably better than the other two, but I lumped them together because A, all three of them left me cold, and B, they have a lot in common.
Okay.
So at the risk of losing what few listeners we still have,
I think this is the shit that people tune in for. I think that's where you're wrong. People are waiting for us to be catty little bitches.
Okay, I'm neither a cat nor a bitch, but maybe it's my advancing age. Because believe it or not, I wanted to like these films.
Okay. I want to like every movie.
These were three of the movies I was most looking forward to this year.
Okay.
And then like dominoes being knocked down. Oh, I don't know, by a catty little bitch. they just proved to be diminishing returns.
Okay.
Maestro, Napoleon, Oppenheimer.
Interesting. Okay.
Now, Maestro is a mess. And it leaves you wondering, this is the gentleman who did A Star Is Born? Because Star Is Born is solid. And I guess Maestro was his dream project for a number of reasons. Napoleon is a very big budget film by Ridley Scott. And Oppenheimer, you know, was directed by Jesus. All three of them are biopics about famous white men. And at this point, I must tread carefully, because in discussing this with my wife, she said I was starting to sound really sexist and ugly.
Oh boy.
And that was not my intention. All three of these films are very critical of their subjects.
Okay.
Except for Oppenheimer, well, to a lesser extent on Oppenheimer, the films don't really seem to be that interested in what made their subjects famous. And Rob was the first one to point this out, in that in his review for F This Movie, he pointed out that Maestro doesn't seem to care that Leonard Bernstein was a musical genius. And after I saw Maestro, I went to the YouTube machine and I watched some videos of the real Leonard Bernstein. And the impression I got was that Bernstein was so brilliant when it came to music, he was capable of thinking about music in a way the rest of us aren't.
Mm-hmm.
If some of you want to seek it out, it was part of a TV special. He talks about the Beatles for 10 minutes. I love the Beatles. This is well known. He talks about the Beatles in a way I've never heard the Beatles talked about. And that's rare, because I've read and seen a lot of things about the Beatles. But because he comes to it from the world of classical music, what he liked about the Beatles was something I had never heard voiced. And the way that he talked about the Beatles was a way I had never heard the Beatles talked about.
I love that.
And so he was a musical genius. I feel safe in saying that. The film does not seem to be interested in his musical career, other than a recreation of him conducting that you can find on YouTube. It's a famous video. It's very much like the end of the Queen movie, where they recreate the Live Aid performance shot for shot. I don't know why.
But he does it in like a single take, and isn't that impressive?
I thought Carey Mulligan walked away from the film because near the end, she reads Bernstein and tells him exactly what's going on, and she's right. And because that paints the film into the corner, the film then spends the next 20 minutes trying to argue that she was wrong, but she wasn't. Because in the one case of the script actually nailing it, I don't want to paraphrase the script. I also don't want people to waste their time watching the film. The film is a mess. Napoleon, too, seems unconcerned with actually exploring what made Napoleon a military genius. Or perhaps it's arguing that he wasn't. You pointed out that there's a longer cut available.
Yeah, not available, but
that might come out.
Correct.
Because the film as it stands is this schizophrenic journey of scenes of two people talking and then epic battle scenes.
Yeah.
It goes back and forth.
Yeah.
And because it's so concerned with Joaquin Phoenix's performance, it largely leaves everyone else in the film except Josephine as ciphers.
Yeah.
It's hard to even tell them apart. And if you're going to make a movie as long as Napoleon, one of the things you can do is develop the other characters. Because the British general he goes up against at the end, I thought that actor,
Rupert Everett,
yes, was doing this great job providing an antithesis to Napoleon, in that Everett does not enjoy battle. To him, this is like swatting a fly, and he doesn't delight in it.
Mm-hmm.
Of the three movies, I'd say Oppenheimer is clearly the best. But again, I don't understand why three films about three very famous people would show so little interest in what made them unique and special, and focus instead on soap opera stuff. That all three films, to a lesser or greater extent, seem much more interested in the characters' private life than in what makes them worthy of a film.
I disagree almost completely in terms of Oppenheimer. I think there is some stuff about his private life, and I think that's some of the stuff in the movie that doesn't work. The Florence Pugh stuff is a very consistent Nolan trope of fridging a female character to give agency to the male character. But I do think most of Oppenheimer is concerned with what did we do, right? Napoleon is a frustrating movie for me because I love Ridley Scott. I think that the battle scenes are pretty great. And like, the problem is he's done that so many times that you're kind of just like, yeah, we know Ridley Scott could do this. I didn't know he could do it in his 80s, but like, Napoleon for me is more, I agree with you. It doesn't seem concerned. It asks us to take on its face Napoleon was a military genius. That's accepted. Let's just move on and let's focus on this weird relationship between him and Josephine.
But from the evidence of the film that we have, not yeah. this mythic longer cut, the film that we have suggests that he got lucky twice.
Sure.
And that he wasn't.
Right.
The stuff that's good in Napoleon, as you just said, Scott did before in Kingdom of Heaven.
Right.
Which got ignored.
Right. Because, again, a longer cut came out that people were like, oh, that movie's really good. But the theatrical cut was kind of a disaster. I like the stuff between him and Josephine. I like when the movie is kind of funny and painting Napoleon as a stooge. I agree that that doesn't jive with him being a military genius. But like when he says destiny has brought me to this lamb chop, that's a funny moment and a deliberately funny moment. I think the movie was more interesting when it was doing that, but it was a very frustrating movie for me. Maestro, I just have to chalk up to like, I don't get it, because I will admit I don't have a ton of interest in Leonard Bernstein. I know very little about him. I was willing for the movie to make him interesting to me, to make me care about his contributions to music and art. And the movie didn't do it. There's almost nothing in that movie that I like. I find it so sweaty. I think the performances are so sweaty. I think the camera work is so sweaty. I think, and I tuned into a podcast that I really like where they were talking about Maestro. And I was like, okay, this movie's going to articulate, or this podcast is going to articulate all the things that I didn't like about the movie. And I'm going to finally focus in on like what my issues with it are. And in the first 5 minutes, they were like, this movie's a near masterpiece. And I was like, I have to turn this off because I don't get it.
And it might be a mistake, I'll admit right now, for me to lump the three films together. That was for convenience.
No, I think there are consistencies across the three of them.
But what leaves me scratching my head, and I don't want to be the guy who tries to remake the film in my own image. In the 50s and 60s, Leonard Bernstein did a series of TV specials called A Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra. That was life-changing for people.
Yeah.
Because he was so smart, he was able to explain things very simply to kids. In fact, that Benjamin Britten stuff that you hear at the end of...
Oh, I know what you're talking about. Moonrise Kingdom.
Moonrise Kingdom.
Yeah, yeah.
Is loosely based on the Bernstein stuff.
Okay.
And it was revelatory. It was groundbreaking. It was amazing television that had never been done before. Now, again, that's not the film Bradley Cooper is making, but why isn't that in the movie?
Or anything like that, because as you're telling me that, I'm like, that sounds interesting. And there's nothing in Maestro that to me was like, that sounds interesting. Nothing.
Because going to see symphony orchestras is expensive. So at the time, Bernstein would have been far more famous for his television work than his conducting work.
Mm-hmm.
So that, I think, alone makes it worth including, because isn't part of this movie is about his relationship with his own fame.
I listen.
The fact that because he wanted a certain level of fame, he couldn't be who he really was.
I have such a cynical read on Maestro, and I apologize to those of you who really liked the movie. I think it's a movie pretending to be an ode to Leonard Bernstein's greatness, but what it really is an ode to Bradley Cooper's greatness. And I don't think he's earned that yet. And I say that as somebody who has liked Bradley Cooper, who really likes A Star Is Born. He's two movies in, and I don't think he's there yet.
The one thing I really enjoyed in Maestro was the performance by Maya Hawke as his daughter.
Sure.
And wanted that to be expanded a little bit.
Right.
Because there's a very wonderful scene where he's thinking of telling her the truth about something and decides not to. And if you're going to go the soap opera route, that might have been a way to make that more compelling. I don't know.
I have two more I don't get it, because one of mine was Maestro. My other two are Asteroid City, which, again, is just a filmmaker who we are growing in different directions, I think. Wes Anderson used to be one of my favorites, and I get to Asteroid City, and I just feel like there's very little here for me. I can appreciate how meticulous and beautiful it is to look at. I have a hard time connecting to it emotionally, and that used to be something that I loved about Wes Anderson movies. And Joel Edmiston and I did a podcast on Bottle Rocket a few weeks ago, and we talked about, like, maybe he's missing the Owen Wilson of it all, that those two collaborated on those first three movies, and those are the ones I connect to emotionally. I haven't even watched his Netflix stuff, and it's just crazy to me that, like, one of someone who used to be one of my favorite filmmakers has new stuff that I can watch without leaving my house, and I'm just like, I'll get to it.
Well, I wrestled with Asteroid City because yeah. I might be a bigger Wes Anderson fan than you.
Sure.
And thought The French Dispatch was just top grade Anderson. And while I agree with you that it's a frustrating film, what made me start liking it a lot more than my first viewing was that he's still doing things that no other filmmaker is doing.
Agreed.
And so I applaud the fact that the film exists, even though big parts of it left me cold. But I also was very taken with the fact Tom Hanks is in Asteroid City and manages to give a Wes Anderson performance in Asteroid City, which I thought was sort of remarkable,
mm-hmm.
given that he's become famous playing Tom Hanks.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying he's playing against type. I'm saying he's such a skilled actor that he's managed to
mm-hmm.
adjust his performance style to fit the rest of the film. If anything, I thought Asteroid City's reach exceeds its grasp, because what he's going for in the meta narrative of the story within the story that's a play, that's a movie, that's these actors, is much less compelling than the story that the story in the film is
right.
trying to tell.
Right.
So But I still applaud the fact that he was trying to do something.
I do, I mean, too. And
there's no other film like it this year.
That is precise. Movies like Asteroid City are precisely why we moved away from overrated, which is you're wrong to like this, and towards I didn't get it, because tons of people love Asteroid City, including people on our site. And you're not wrong. I'm the problem. I'm the one who watched Asteroid City and was like, huh, I don't know. It's not connecting with me.
Plus, for decades, I've wanted to see Jeff Goldblum play a space alien. And Wes Anderson finally made that dream come true.
Hello, Earth Girls Are Easy got to it first.
Boy, the speed at which you, man, I am. You have shown me up, Patrick Bromley.
My last one is Saltburn, which again has shown up on some top 10 lists, and I'm seeing on Twitter now, especially, that it's available on Amazon Prime, a sort of groundswell, tweets that reference the Saltburn Hive. It's very reminiscent of last year's fucking, why can't I think of it? Silent Movies, you didn't like it either. Oh my God, Margot Robbie.
Oh, Babylon.
Babylon, thank you. God, the only word in my head right now is Maestro. Babylon. It reminds me a lot of Babylon, which is
because the sequel is going to be called Babylon, Maestro. It's about Bernstein's final year.
A movie that didn't work for me at all. And again, the cynical side of me would argue is very self-satisfied, but has this sort of cult audience that really connects to it. Saltburn is very similar to that, where it's like, I didn't like anything about this movie. I find it very self-satisfied. It exists to inspire memes, I think, but people are really connecting to it and digging it, and more power to it.
I was warned against Saltburn by many people. And then when we went to Burbank to see Dream Scenario, because God knows you can't show Dream Scenario in Oxnard, there was an enormous three-story tall poster in the courtyard for Saltburn. And we saw a very good trailer for Saltburn before Dream Scenario. And that almost made me go see it, but I didn't.
It's on Prime. You can watch it at home.
My final I don't get it. And again, might have been one of my most anticipated films. William Friedkin passed this year, and we did a podcast on that. And his final film was an adaptation of the Kane Mutiny Court Martial.
Oh, yeah.
It took forever to get released, and it's not good.
Oh, bummer.
I don't know why. There's very little Friedkin in it. The performers try very hard. But the problem, I think, is we have the theatrical version, which is rightly hailed with the iconic Bogart performance. And then in the 70s or 80s, Robert Altman did a version of it with Eric Bogosian, which is amazing. And you can rent that very cheaply on Amazon Prime. And it's terrific. So why we want to do a new version, I don't know. It's pretty hard to beat the other two. Why can't I remember this actor's name? He's in one of the first of the Planet of the Apes reboots.
Yeah, he's in Oppenheimer. Yeah, he's in Oppenheimer, and Jason Clarke.
Jason Clarke plays the lead, and where's my brain? This shows how memorable it was. It's
Kiefer Sutherland is in it.
Kiefer Sutherland plays the Queeg part, and he tries, and he to give him credit, he tries to go in a different direction. Because Bogart has sort of made that performance. But I would say that was my most disappointing watch of the year. Okay. And not just because it was Friedkin's last film.
Sure.
It's because it's a piece that I hold close to my heart. I really, really like that book. And when the Bogart film came out, there were lines that were considered so incendiary that while they were part of the play, they were not included in the movie. So when you watch the Robert Altman version, it's decades later, and they were able to include the lawyer who defends the mutineers has a speech at the end that's justifiably famous, and in the Altman version, it's unexpurgated from the original text, and it's just searing.
Which brings us to the ugly movies that we really didn't like and make no qualms about not liking. I didn't get it is like, I didn't like this, but you might. Ugly is like, maybe nobody should like this because this is just bad.
Well, and where do we start? The other night, my son and I were having a discussion. He thinks it's been a great year for movies.
I think it's been the best year in a long time.
And looking at my 10 best list that we're going to discuss next week and the runners up, he might be on to something.
Yeah.
But casually, if you had just said to me, what kind of a year was it? It just casually, I wouldn't automatically say it was great.
Okay.
And part of it was the films we're about to discuss. And I wish I had enough money so that if any of our listeners ever felt like watching these films, they could contact me on the Twitter machine and I would Venmo them $20 to not watch it.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I wish I had that ability. Apparently, Clooney used to give people refunds for Batman Forever.
That's bullshit. First of all, he wasn't in Batman Forever. Second of all,
because everything after the one you showed a couple weeks ago, I lumped together as
he's in Batman and Robin.
Joel Schumacher neon trash. I am such a fan of Batman Returns and am still angry that we never got the third Burton film. Let's just leave it at that.
There's a ton of stuff I like in Batman Returns, but watching it for Smash Cut a couple weeks ago on the big screen, I was like, I think I've gotten everything I'm going to get out of this movie.
It's endlessly fascinating. The whole McDonald's thing that gets attached to it is also fascinating to me.
Yeah.
I don't think there are two bigger fans of the Haunted Mansion as a theme park ride as Patrick and myself.
Yeah.
And Disney has tried and failed in the past to bring this property to the screen. Famously, at one point, Guillermo del Toro wanted to do it, and he was told, no thanks, we'll pass on that. And then this thing comes out, and I've heard so many people talk about how it wasn't as bad as they thought, but it's bad. It's just talk about different color script pages. And I don't mean to be the kind of podcaster who plays the game, here's what the film should have been. But a couple days after we saw it, and we were still trying to get it out of our brains, my wife came up with the answer. She said Disney should reboot The Haunted Mansion as an anthology film. Mm-mm. And the different segments, a la Creepshow,
right,
should be about the different elements of the Haunted Mansion,
sure,
and the backstory behind there. So we would have 20 minutes about the bride, and this would be it. Mm-hmm. And then not only would it be more like the ride, but it would be truer to the spirit of how do you turn a haunted house into a movie. There's no one more excited about a Haunted Mansion movie than me. I'm turning in my office, and there are this year's Hallmark Haunted Mansion ornaments, where if you wire them together, they put on a little show for you. And at the risk of annoying Patrick.
Can't hear it.
Can you hear that?
Barely.
Anyway, it's terrific. In fact, two of those were gifts from your wife.
Yeah.
And the other one I had to seek out at a Hallmark. Oh, okay, so no one's a bigger fan. I want it to work. I'm not sitting there hating the film before it starts. I want this to work.
Obviously.
God damn it, I want this to work.
Yeah.
And why on earth they would take the two tacks that they took in the Eddie Murphy movie and this, I don't know, because it doesn't work. It doesn't work at all. I don't understand what pleasure you can get out of it. And earlier in the year, Adam Foss said he put it on for his kids.
Yeah.
And discovered it was too scary for them. So that in itself In the words of the authors of The Unofficial Guide to Disney, many children work themselves up to being scared and don't want to go on the ride. The actual ride is as scary as a whoopee cushion.
This is another example of, like, we didn't get to the movies to see it because that's become increasingly hard to do with our schedules. It's been available on Disney Plus for months, and we're just kind of like, eh, maybe we'll get to it. Like, it's movie fatigue. I heard enough negative stuff. For whatever reason, I still haven't seen it.
Again, here, I could opine on this for an hour, but talk about lazy. Well, if it's a narrative film, there needs to be a villain. Who should be the villain? Oh, I don't know. Well, at this point, I don't know if I want to spoil it.
Okay.
I don't think it's a spoiler. Who should be the villain, corporate Disney content service provider? Oh, I don't know. The Hatbox Ghost?
Mm.
It's just, it's like the screenwriters rode the ride once.
It's a bummer.
And in the same breath, God, I hated this movie. And I wanted to love it, but I have now run out of patience with David Gordon Green and his cynical marketing ploy to the studios. Tell you what I'm going to do. He's like the music man selling them 76 trombones or selling them a monorail or something. And you know what? You're going to get three movies out of it because I know how to tell a story so that people, Exorcist Believer is so awful in so many ways, and actually not only takes a page from the Halloween sequels, but also from the last three Star Wars films, in that the structure, the trope has become, okay, in the first movie, we're going to be really cynical and bring someone back from the original beloved film that everyone thought was dead.
Right.
That's just setting the stage. Because, spoiler alert, at the end of Exorcist Believer, we get a big hint about who's coming back for the second one. And so it just becomes, here's something you like. Here's like they're dangling cat toys in front of us.
Mm-hmm.
And Exorcist Believer is so idiotic. There's a scene where, like, everyone in the room takes a turn doing an exorcism, like, okay, mom, now it's your turn. It's just awful.
I'm about 50 minutes into it because I started watching it on Peacock for this show.
And?
I don't like anything, but I don't like exorcism movies. I mean, it's a subgenre of horror that I'm not really into. Ellen Burstyn hasn't even shown up yet. Like, he just found his daughter.
But it shows you why the original is the masterpiece it is.
Sure.
Because if anything, before anyone knew this, Friedkin knew it's really hard to do an Exorcist movie.
Yeah.
Well, Bill, how do you know this? We don't have an Exorcist. Oh, trust me.
Right.
You'll find out. And actually, before he died, he shit-talked this one.
I know he did.
There's an interview where he said, did you see who they're handing this to?
I think if anybody's going to come back from the dead just to shit-talk stuff, it's William Friedkin. He's the best.
So if you ever feel like watching it,
yeah,
don't.
Okay.
And watch that Friedkin documentary instead.
Okay.
Where he just talks for an hour and a half.
Yeah.
That movie's fucking fascinating.
Okay.
That movie's endlessly fascinating. Although, to be fair, Patrick, you need to finish Exorcist Believer, because if you think the first hour...
It's all set up. Where I'm at is all set up.
It's just shake your head bad.
And I don't hate those David Gordon Green Halloween movies. I think there's interesting stuff in all three of them, but I don't think the approach is just a one size fits all kind of a thing where it's like, well, let's do that for The Exorcist now.
There are parts of the three Halloween movies I like. I think my biggest problem is that the narrative structure of the three has been subsumed by marketing concerns.
Yeah.
But you can't tell the story you want to tell because certain things need to be saved for the third film. And also, at one point, am I remembering this correctly? Spoiler alert for the Halloween sequels. Doesn't Judy Greer get dispatched?
Yes, at the end of Halloween Kills.
That seemed to me to be a mistake.
Anytime you have Judy Greer in a movie, you want to keep Judy Greer in your movie.
Okay, so it's not just me.
No!
And at this point, if you ever feel like watching Exorcist Believer, get a streaming service that includes this one season only sitcom called Reboot.
Hulu.
Which was delightful and didn't get renewed. And watch that and say, oh, television can be these things.
Right.
And we're not allowed to watch it anymore. Because Judy Greer's on that show, and she's kind of amazing in that. As is
everybody was good on that show, yeah.
Why didn't that get a second season?
Because we're in the worst possible timeline for everything.
In the words of Robbie Christino, because Hollywood doesn't know what it's
like. That's right. What else is on your ugly list?
Well, I went with my neighbors. We had a go out of the condo movie night, you know, with the other residents of the home. And we all went to see Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny.
Mm.
And there's just not much left there.
No, it's Disney had a bad year. Charlie and I were having a long conversation the other night about.
And I'm a fan of James Mangold.
Me too.
And man, he works up a steam, and it's this empty shadow show.
Yeah, it's trying, you know, and I can't hate it because it's trying, and I like Phoebe Waller-Bridge, even though I think she's underserved by the movie. And
it's nice to see Karen Allen getting work.
It's great to see Karen Allen getting work. And oddly enough, my mother-in-law's partner, Bruce, who you know, likes it so much that he couldn't wait for the DVD to come out. So he bought like a weird Japanese import. And my mother-in-law has told me this story, and I can tell it on here because they will never listen to this. Every time he would have a new group of friends over, he would show them Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny because he likes it so much that he wants to keep introducing it. So my mother-in-law has had to sit through this movie 5 times now. And anything that brings him this much joy, I can't shit on too much, but I'm not really a fan of the movie. It didn't work for me.
But has she told you how she feels about sitting through it 5 times?
Oh, no, she's not crazy about it. She didn't love the movie either.
And what does he love about it?
I don't know. I don't know.
Could it be the fact that it's Indiana Jones?
Sure.
And it's just a piece of his childhood that he treasured?
Perhaps.
Finally.
Yeah.
I meant to see this in a theater. And, you know, sometimes you're lazy. So I finally caught it on streaming. It's called Strays.
Oh, yeah.
And it has a good heart, and it's trying to be funny, and it's Lord Miller, and I give Lord Miller a lot of credit for things, but ultimately, it's made for 11-year-olds who really shouldn't be going to an R-rated movie yet.
Right.
And so anything interesting or actually funny it has to say is subsumed by its need to be really gross.
Sure.
I mean, patently offensive every 10 minutes. So much like Bridesmaids, we get some material that's actually interesting and sweet. At one point, the dogs accidentally eat mushrooms, and their psychedelic experience is portrayed as they see the world as sock puppets and animation alternately. And that was funny. But then, oh, look at your watch. Here comes the poop. Here comes a dog penis whose erection is used to get some keys off the wall of a cage facility.
Okay.
So again, I know it's a comedy. I know I'm supposed to suspend my disbelief, but this is a dog penis that's 6 feet long on a 2 foot long dog. Have I not owned enough dogs in my life?
I guess not. Not the right kind.
It's a movie with no audience.
Yeah.
Adult?
I remember the hallucination stuff from the Red Band trailer, because even dogs can be dirty. I like dogs, but I skipped it.
I think if a group of 11-year-olds snuck in, I don't know. Because of some of the people who did the voice work, and because Will Forte's in it briefly, I thought it might be worth something. My son did behind the scenes a few weeks ago on a Will Forte project, and spoke with him briefly and said that he's delightful.
Oh, nice.
Which I'm happy to hear, because he's...
You want to hear good things about people you like.
I asked my son to express to Will Forte how disappointed we were that Last Man on Earth didn't get its final season to conclude the story.
Is that it for your uglies?
Yes, although I do wonder, I have a question for our listeners, the diehard listeners who are still with us. Something similar happened last year, I think. I brought up a number of films that I thought no one had seen.
Oh, yeah.
And I was so confident.
Lots
no
of people
one
had,
has seen
yeah.
these. And then in the comments, I was made aware that there were people who actually saw them. So when going through the complete list of films released in this country last year, or this year, my question that I leave you with is, has anyone seen the film Frankenspy?
I mean, maybe.
That was a film
this
year that got a theatrical release. Frankenspy. Not Frankenshark, which is the retitled Dick Shark, which we've been following.
Which
that
you have seen, story. Right.
I'm wondering if anyone has seen Frankenspy and if it's worth our time.
I have five quick uglies that I'll rattle off, because each represents sort of the worst of a couple of trends. The worst of the streaming content, Amazon Content Studios, is a movie made for Apple called Ghosted, which is like Chris Evans and Ana de Armas in an action comedy.
I remember there were trailers for that in the theater. They showed trailers for that in movie theaters.
It's a movie written and directed by an algorithm. It represents the nadir of the let's make content for streaming. The worst of the big budget, let's take an IP that we have, sort of, I thought was Disney's remake of The Little Mermaid. Halle Bailey has a beautiful voice and she's really trying, but it's somehow adds an hour to The Little Mermaid.
Wow.
Mostly, I guess, I don't know. There's like a Lin-Manuel Miranda duck rap that Adam was goofing on in last week's holiday show. It's whatever. The worst, this isn't the worst of any trend, but Hypnotic was a movie that Ben Affleck sleepwalks through. It's directed by Robert Rodriguez. We did a whole Patreon show on it, so go listen to that. The worst of the holiday movies, which I wasn't going to put on this list because I was like, I don't know if this even counts. It's not even a movie. It's called Best Christmas Ever with Heather Graham and Brandy. And I was like, not going to put it on this list because I felt like it was punching down. But then Adam and Allison Thaws watch Christmas movies every year and they write columns about it. And they both put it at the bottom of their list. Their list is now 25 movies deep. They've watched 25 of these fucking things. And they have said this is the worst of them. And they watch stuff like Christmas in the Jungle and A Wine Christmas. I'm making these titles up. But like, they sit through what I think is the worst of the worst. And they both agree Best Christmas Ever is the worst of these movies. So I feel confident in saying that even at like 75 minutes on Netflix, this movie is terrible.
And that's on Netflix.
And that's on Netflix. It's directed by Mary Lambert, who's a director I like.
Pet Sematary.
She made Pet Sematary. And then the worst movie I saw in a theater this year is Expendables 4. which is, I am the audience for Expendables 4. I have found things to like in all three of the previous Expendables movies. And I saw it with Adam Riske and Adam Thaws and Mike, and we sat down excited to see a new Expendables movie. And 5 minutes in, we were turning to each other like, oh, shit, we have all made a mistake.
And that's the audience for Expendables 4, because I fully expected the screenwriters of Expendable 4, you know, those two computer algorithms, to call the four of you for suggestions.
Yes, they should have.
What do you four guys think should happen in this fourth one?
We could have given them plenty of ideas that would have made for a much better movie.
Where should we go with this concept?
It's shockingly bad. I will agree with your son that this was a pretty good year for movies. I had a much easier time making my top 10 than I have for years. I had to leave movies off.
And looking at my top 10 list, as it turns out, it usually turns out this way. My son was right. I'm very happy with my top 10 list. And yeah. I also have 10 runners up.
Yeah, it's good. So watch one of the 18 movies we suggested in our underrated section. Skip the uglies and, you know, let us know if you disagree about the We Didn't Get It, because obviously there's an audience for those movies and we're just not it.
Send me a direct message on Twitter if you ever feel like watching The Haunted Mansion, and I'll shoot a couple dollars your way. I'm lying. I'm on a fixed income.
Let us know if you saw Frankenspy, and we'll be back next week with our favorite movies of 2023, one of my favorite shows to do all year. I love that show. So thanks, JB, for talking about these movies with me. And we'll see you guys next week.
Merry Christmas.
Thanks for listening to FS Movie.